Historia Britonum, contains some documents earlier than Bede. Finally, in the 9th century, and very likely at the direction of King Alfred, various annals preserved in different monasteries were put together as the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. Checking these with each other, and by such certainties as archaeology allows us to entertain, we have the following picture. Imitating a common Roman practice, the dominant British chief, about AD 450, sought to strengthen himself by bringing in a band of mercenaries from over the seas. They proved a trap. Once the road was open, fresh fleet loads made their way across and up the rivers, from the Humber, perhaps as far round as Portsmouth. But the British resistance stiffened as the invaders got away from the coast, and their advance was brought to a standstill for nearly 50 years by a great battle won at Mount Baden. So far, this tale is confirmed, historically and geographically. Gildas could have heard the story of the mercenaries from old men whom he'd known in his youth, and there's no real ground for doubting the statements of Nennius, a compiler probably of the 9th century, and Bede, who agreed that the name of the deceived chief who invited these deadly foes was Vortigern. Hengist, a name frequently mentioned in northern story, like a medieval mercenary, was ready to sell his sword and his ships to anyone who would give him land on which to support his men. And what he took was the future kingdom of Kent. Gildas has a tale to tell of this tragedy. No sooner have they, the Britons, gone back to their land than the foul hosts of the Picts and Scots land promptly from their coracles. These two races differ in part in their manners, but they agree in their lust for blood, and in their habit of covering their hangdog faces with hair, instead of covering with clothing those parts of their bodies which demand it. They seize all the northern and outlying parts of the country as far as to the wall. Upon this wall stands a timorous and unwarlike garrison. The wretched citizens are pulled down from the wall and dashed to the ground by the hooked weapons of their naked foes. What shall I add? The citizens desert the high wall and their towns, and take to a flight more desperate than any before. Again, the enemy pursue them, and there is slaughter more cruel than ever. As lambs by butchers, so are our piteous citizens rent by their foes, till their manner of sojourning might be compared to that of wild beasts. For they maintain themselves by robbery for the sake of a little food. Thus, calamities from outside were increased by native feuds. So frequent were these disasters that the country was stripped of food, save what could be procured in the chase. Therefore again did the wretched remnant send a letter to Aetius, a powerful Roman. To Aetius, 3 times consul, the groans of the Britons. The barbarians drive us to the sea. The sea drives us to the barbarians. Between these two methods of death, we are either massacred or drowned. But they got no help. Meantime, dire famine compelled many to surrender to their spoilers. But others would in no wise surrender, but kept on sallying from the mountains, caves, passes, and thick coppices. And then, for the first time, trusting not in man, but in God, they slaughtered the foes who for so many years had been plundering their country. For a time, the boldness of our enemies was checked, but not the wickedness of our own countrymen. The enemy left our citizens, but our citizens did not leave their sins. Nennius tells us what Gildas omits, the name of the British soldier who won the crowning mercy of Mount Badon. And that name takes us out of the mist of dimly remembered history into the daylight of romance. There looms, large, uncertain, dim, but glittering, the legend of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. Somewhere in the island, a great captain gathered the forces of Roman Britain and fought the barbarian invaders to the death. Around him, around his name and his deeds, shine all that romance and poetry can bestow. 12 battles, all located in scenes untraceable, with foes unknown, except that they were heathen, are punctiliously set forth in the Latin of Nennius. Other authorities say, no Arthur, at least, no proof of any Arthur. It was only when Geoffrey of Monmouth, 600 years later, was praising the splendours of feudalism and martial aristocracy, that chivalry, honour, the Christian faith, knights in steel and ladies bewitching, are enshrined in a glorious circle lit by victory. Later, these tales would be retold and embellished by the genius of Malory, Spencer, and Tennyson. True or false, they've gained an immortal hold upon the thoughts of men. It's difficult to believe it was all an invention of a Welsh writer. If it was, he must have been a marvellous inventor. Modern research has not accepted the annihilation of Arthur. Timidly but resolutely, the latest and best-informed writers unite to proclaim his reality. They cannot tell when in this dark period he lived, or where he held sway and fought his battles. They're ready to believe, however, that there was a great British warrior who kept the light of civilization burning against all the storms that beat, and that behind his sword there sheltered a faithful following of which the memory did not fail. All four groups of the Celtic tribes which dwelt in the tilted uplands of Britain cheered themselves with the Arthurian legend, and each claimed their own region as the scene of his exploits. From Cornwall to Cumberland, a search for Arthur's realm or sphere has been pursued. The reserve of modern assertions is sometimes pushed to extremes, in which the fear of being contradicted leads the writer to strip himself of almost all sense and meaning. One specimen of this method will suffice. It is reasonably certain that a petty chieftain named Arthur did exist, probably in South Wales. It is possible that he may have held some military command uniting the tribal forces of the Celtic or Highland zone, or part of it against raiders and invaders, not all of them necessarily Teutonic. It is also possible that he may have engaged in all or some of the battles attributed to him. On the other hand, this attribution may belong to a later date. This is not much to show after so much toil and learning. Nonetheless, to have established a basis of fact for the story of Arthur is a service which should be respected. In this account, we prefer to believe that the story with which Geoffrey delighted the fiction-loving Europe of the 12th century is not all fancy. If we could see exactly what happened, we should find ourselves in the presence of a theme as well-founded, as inspired, and as inalienable from the inheritance of mankind as the Odyssey or the Old Testament. It is all true, or it ought to be, and more and better besides. And wherever men are fighting against barbarism, tyranny and massacre, for freedom, law and honour, let them remember that the fame of their deeds, even though they themselves be exterminated, may perhaps be celebrated as long as the world rolls round. Let us then declare that King Arthur and his noble knights, guarding the sacred flame of Christianity and the theme of a world order sustained by valour, physical strength and good horses and armour, slaughtered innumerable hosts of foul barbarians and set decent folk an example for all time. We are told he was Dux Bellorum. What could be more natural or more necessary than that a commander-in-chief should be accepted, a new Count of Britain, such as the Britons had appealed to Aetius to give them 50 years before? Once Arthur is recognised as the commander of a mobile field army, moving from one part of the country to another, and uniting with local forces in each district, the disputes about the scenes of his actions explain themselves. Moreover, the 4th century witnessed the rise of cavalry to the dominant position in the battlefield. The day of infantry had passed for a time, and the day of the legion had passed forever. The Saxon invaders were infantry, fighting with sword and spear and having little armour. Against such an enemy, a small force of ordinary Roman cavalry might well prove invincible. If a chief like Arthur had gathered a band of mail-clad cavalry, he could have moved freely about Britain, everywhere heading the local resistance to the invader and gaining repeated victories. The memory of Arthur carried with it the hope that a deliverer would return one day. The legend lived upon the increasing tribulations of the age. Arthur has been described as the last of the Romans. He understood Roman ideas and used them for the good of the British people. The heritage of Rome, Professor Collingwood says, lives on in many shapes, but of the men who created that heritage, Arthur was the last, and the story of Roman Britain ends with him. Arthur's 12th battle, says Nennius, was on Mount Badon, in which there fell in one day 960 men from the onslaught of Arthur only, and no one laid them low save he alone. And in all his battles he was victor. But they, when in all these battles they'd been overthrown, sought help from Germany and increased without intermission. All efforts to fix the battlefield of Mount Badon have failed. 100 learned investigations have brought no results, but if, as seems most probable, it was fought in the debatable land to check the advance from the east, then the best claimant to the title is Liddington Camp, which looks down on Badbury near Swindon. On the other hand, we're able to fix the date with unusual accuracy. Gildas speaks of it as having occurred 43 years and a month from the date when he was writing, and he says that he remembers the date because it was that of his own birth. Now, we know from his book that the King of North Wales, Maelgwn, was still alive when he wrote, and the annals of Cambria tell us that he died of the plague in 547. Gildas thus wrote at the latest in this year, and the Battle of Mount Badon, 43 years earlier, would have been fought in 503. We have also a cross-check in the Irish annals, which state that Gildas died in 569 or 570. His birth is therefore improbable before 490, and thus the date of the battle seems to be fixed between 490 and 503. A broader question is keenly disputed. Did the invaders exterminate the native population, or did they superimpose themselves upon them and become to some extent blended with them? Here it's necessary to distinguish between the age of fierce forays in search of plunder and the age of settlement. Gildas is speaking of the former, and the scenes he described were repeated in the Danish invasions 3 centuries later. But to the settler, such raids are only occasional incidents in a life mainly occupied in subduing the soil, and in that engrossing task, labour is as important as land. The evidence of place names suggests that in Sussex, extermination was the rule. Farther west, there are grounds for thinking that a substantial British population survived, and the oldest West Saxon code of AD 694 makes careful provision for the rights of Welshmen of various degrees, substantial landowners, and the king's Welshmen who ride his errands, his native gallopers, in fact, who knew the ancient trackways. Even where self-interest did not preserve the native villagers as labourers on Saxon farms, we may cherish the hope that somewhere a maiden's cry for pity, the appeal of beauty in distress, the lustful needs of an invading force, would create some bond between victor and vanquished. Thus the blood would be preserved. Thus the rigours of subjugation would fade as generations passed away. The complete obliteration of an entire race over large areas is repulsive to the human mind. There should at least have been, in default of pity, a hearing for practical advantage or the natural temptations of sex. Thus, serious writers contend that the Anglo-Saxon conquest was for the bulk of the British community mainly a change of masters. The rich were slaughtered. The brave and proud fell back in large numbers upon the western mountains. Other numerous bands escaped betimes to Brittany, whence their remote posterity were one day to return. The Saxon was, moreover, a valley settler. His notion of an economic holding was a meadow for hay near the stream, the lower slopes under the plough, the upper slopes kept for pasture. But in many places a long time must have passed before these lower grounds could be cleared and drained, and while this work was in progress, what did he live on but the produce of the upland British farms? It is more natural to suppose that he would keep his natives working as serfs on the land with which they were familiar until the valley was ready for sowing. Then the old British farms would go down to grass, and the whole population would cluster in the village by the stream or the spring. But the language of the valley settlers, living in compact groups, would be dominant over that of the hill cultivators, scattered in small and isolated holdings. The study of modern English place names has shown that hill, wood, and stream names are often Celtic in origin, even in regions where the village names are Anglo-Saxon. In this way, without assuming any wholesale extermination, the disappearance of the British language can be explained even in areas where we know a British population to have survived. They had to learn the language of their masters. There was no need for their masters to learn theirs. Thus it came about that both Latin and British yielded to the speech of the newcomers so completely that hardly a trace of either is to be found in our earliest records. No uniformity of practice prevailed in the island. There's good reason to think that the newcomers in Kent settled down beside the old inhabitants, whose name, Kentiaki, they adopted. In Northumbria, there are strong traces of Celtic lore. In Hants and Wilts, a broad belt of British names, from Liss to Deverill, seems to show the natives still cultivating their old fields on the downs, while a Saxon was clearing the valleys. There was no colour bar. In physical type, the two races resembled each other, and the probabilities are that in many districts a substantial British element was incorporated in the Saxon stock. The invaders themselves were not without their yearnings for settled security. Their hard laws, the rigours they endured, were but the results of the immense pressures behind them as the hordes of avid humanity spread westward from Central Asia. The warriors returning from a 6 months' foray liked to sprawl in lazy repose. Evidently, they were not insensible to progressive promptings. But where, asked the chiefs and elders, could safety be found? In the 5th century, as the pressure from the east grew harder, and as the annual raiding parties returned from Britain with plunder and tales of wealth, there was created in the ruling minds a sense of the difficulty of getting to the island, and consequently of the security which would attend its occupation by a hardy and valiant race. Here, perhaps, in this wave-lapped island, men might settle down and enjoy the good things of life, without the haunting fear of subjugation by a stronger hand, and without the immense daily sacrifices inseparable from military and tribal discipline on the mainland. To these savage swords, Britain seemed a refuge. In the wake of the raiders, there grew steadily the plan and system of settlement. Thus, with despair behind and hope before, the migration to Britain and its occupation grew from year to year. Of all the tribes of the Germanic race, none was more cruel than the Saxons. Their very name, which spread to the whole confederacy of northern tribes, was supposed to be derived from the use of a weapon, the sea-axe, a short, one-handed sword. Although tradition and the Venerable Bede assign the conquest of Britain to the Angles, Jutes, and Saxons together, and although the various settlements have tribal peculiarities, it's probable that before their general exodus from Schleswig-Holstein, the Saxons had virtually incorporated the other two strains. The history books of our childhood attempted courageously to prescribe exact dates for all the main events. In 449, Hengist and Horsa, invited by Vortigern, founded the Jutish kingdom of Kent upon the corpses of its former inhabitants. In 477, Ella and his three sons arrived to continue the inroad. In 495, Cherdic and Kinrich appeared. In 501, Port, the pirate, founded Portsmouth. In 514, the West Saxons, Stuf and Witgar, descended in their turn and put the Britons to flight. In 544, Witgar was killed. In 547 came Ida, founder of the Kingdom of Northumberland. All that can be said about these dates is that they correspond broadly to the facts, and that these successive waves of invaders, bringing behind them settlers, descended on our unhappy shores. Other authorities draw an alternative picture. The bulk of the homesteads within the village, J.R. Green tells us, were those of its freemen or churls. But among these were the larger homes of earls, or men distinguished among their fellows by noble blood, who were held in an hereditary reverence, and from whom the leaders of the village were chosen in wartime, or rulers in time of peace. But the choice was a purely voluntary one, and a man of noble blood enjoyed no legal privilege among his fellows. If this were so, we might thus early have realized the democratic ideal of the association of us all through the leadership of the best. In the tribal conceptions of the Germanic nation lie, no doubt, many of those principles which are now admired and which have formed a recognizable part of the message which the English-speaking peoples have given to the world. But the conquerors of Roman Britain, far from practicing these ideals, introduced a whole scheme of society which was fundamentally sordid and vicious. The invaders brought into Britain a principle common to all Germanic tribes, namely, the use of the money power to regulate all the legal relations of men. If there was any equality, it was equality within each social grade. If there was liberty, it was mainly liberty for the rich. If there were rights, they were primarily the rights of property. There was no crime committed which could not be compounded by a money payment. Except failure to answer a call to join an expedition, there was no offence more heinous than that of theft. An elaborate tariff prescribed in shillings the Wehrgeld, or exact value or worth of every man. An athling, or prince, was worth 1,500 shillings, a shilling being the value of a cow in Kent, or of a sheep elsewhere. An earl, or nobleman, 300 shillings. A churl, now degraded to the word churl, who was a yeoman farmer, was worth 100 shillings. A light, or agricultural serf, 40 to 80 shillings, and a slave, nothing. All these laws were logically and mathematically pushed to their extremes. If a churl killed an earl, he had to pay 3 times as much in compensation as if the earl were the murderer. And these laws were applied to the families of all. The life of a slaughtered man could be compounded for cash. With money, all was possible. Without it, only retribution or loss of liberty. However, the athling, valued at 1,500 shillings, suffered in certain respects. The penalty for slander was the tearing out of the tongue. If an athling were guilty of this offence, his tongue was worth 5 times that of an earl and 15 times as much as that of a common light, and he could ransom it only on these terms. Thus, the abuse of a humble tongue was cheap. Wehrgeld, at least, as Alfred said long afterwards, was better than the blood feud. The foundation of the Germanic system was blood and kin. The family was the unit, the tribe was the whole. The great transition which we witness among the emigrants is the abandonment of blood and kin as the theme of their society, and its replacement by local societies and lordship based on the ownership of land. This change arose, like so many of the lessons learned by men, from the grim needs of war. Fighting for life and foothold against men as hard-pressed as themselves, each pioneering band fell inevitably into the hands of the bravest, most commanding, most fortunate war leader. This was no longer a foray of a few months, or at the outside, a year. Here were settlements to be founded, new lands to be reclaimed and cultivated, lands which, moreover, offered to the deeper plough a virgin fertility. These must be guarded, and who could guard them except the bold chieftains who'd gained them over the corpses of their former owners? Thus, the settlement in England was to modify the imported structure of Germanic life. The armed, farmer colonists found themselves forced to accept a stronger state authority owing to the stresses of continued military action. In Germany, they had no kings. They developed them in Britain from leaders who claimed descent from the ancient gods. The position of the king continually increased in importance, and his supporters or companions gradually formed a new class in society which carried with it the germ of feudalism and was in the end to dominate all other conventions. But the lord was master. He must also be protector. He must stand by his people, must back them in the courts, feed them in time of famine, and they in return must work his land and follow him in war. The king was at first only the war leader made permanent, but once set up, he had his own interests, his own needs, and his own mortal dangers. To make himself secure became his paramount desire. To be thus is nothing, but to be safely thus. But how was this to be achieved? only by the king gathering round him a band of the most successful warriors and interesting them directly in the conquest and in the settlement. He had nothing to give them except land. There must be a hierarchy. The king must be surrounded by those who'd shared his deeds and his bounty. The spoils of war were soon consumed, but the land remained forever. Land there was in plenty, of varying quality and condition, but to give individual warriors a title to any particular tract was contrary to the whole tradition of the Germanic tribes. Now, under the hard pressures of war and pioneering, land increasingly became private property. Insensibly, at first, but with growing speed from the 7th century onwards, a landed aristocracy was created owing all it had to the king. While the resistance of the Britons was vigorously maintained, and the fortunes of the struggle swung this way and that way for nearly 200 years, this new institution of personal leadership, established in the divinely descended war chief, sank deeply into the fibre of the Anglo-Saxon invaders. But with this movement towards a more coherent policy or structure of society, there came also a welter of conflicting minor powers. Distances were usually prohibitive, and writing virtually unknown. Districts were separated from each other like islands in rough seas, and thus a host of kings and kinglets sprang into existence behind the fighting frontier of the intruding tribes. In marking the many root faults and vices which they possessed, a high place must be assigned to their inability to combine. For a long time, the island presented only the spectacle of a chaos arising from the strife of small, fiercely organized entities. Although from the time of the immigration, the people south of the Humber were generally subject to a common overlord, they were never able to carry the evolution of kingship forward to a national throne. They remained marauders, but they'd taken more pains to be sure of their booty. Much has been written about the enervating character of Roman rule in Britain, and how the people were rendered lax and ineffectual by the modest comforts which it supplied. There's no doubt that Gildas, by his writings, imparted an impression, perhaps in this case well-founded, of gross incompetence and fatuity in the society and administration which followed the decay of Roman power. But justice to this vanished epoch demands recognition of the fact that the Britons fought those who are now called the English for nearly 250 years. For 100 years they fought them under the aegis of Rome, with its world organization. But for 150 years they fought them alone. The conflict ebbed and flowed. British victories were gained, which once, for a whole generation, brought the conquest to a halt. And in the end, the mountains, which even the Romans had been unable to subdue, proved an invincible citadel of the British race. Chapter 5. England. A red sunset, a long night, a pale, misty dawn. But as the light grows, it becomes apparent to remote posterity that everything has changed. Night had fallen on Britannia. Dawn rose on England, humble, poor, barbarous, degraded and divided, but alive. Britannia had been an active part of a world state. England was once again a barbarian island. It had been Christian, it was now heathen. Its inhabitants had rejoiced in well-planned cities with temples, markets, academies. They'd nourished craftsmen and merchants, professors of literature and rhetoric. For 400 years there'd been order and law, respect for property, and a widening culture. All had vanished. The buildings, such as they were of wood, not stone. The people had lost entirely the art of writing. Some miserable runic scribblings were the only means by which they could convey their thoughts or wishes to one another at a distance. Barbarism reigned in its rags, without even the stern military principles which had animated and preserved the Germanic tribes. The confusion and conflict of petty ruffians, sometimes called kings, racked the land. There was nothing worthy of the name of nationhood, or even of tribalism. Yet this is a transition which the learned men of the 19th century banded themselves together to proclaim as an onward step in the march of mankind. We wake from an awful, and it might well have seemed, endless nightmare to a scene of utter prostration. nor did the seeds of recovery spring from the savage hordes who'd wrecked the Roman culture. They would certainly have continued to welter indefinitely in squalor, but for the fact that a new force was stirring beyond the seas, which, moving slowly, fitfully, painfully, among the ruins of civilization, reached at length by various paths the unhappy island, to which, according to Procopius, the souls of the dead upon the mainland were ferried over by some uncouth Charon. Christianity had not been established as the religion of the empire during the first two centuries of the Roman occupation of Britain. It grew with many other cults in the large and easy tolerance of the imperial system. There arose, however, a British Christian church, which sent its bishops to the early councils, and had, as we've seen, sufficient vitality to develop the Pelagian heresy from its own unaided heart-searchings. When the evil days overtook the land and the long struggle with the Saxons was fought out, the British church fell back with other survivors upon the western parts of the island. Such was the gulf between the warring races that no attempt was made at any time by the British bishops to Christianize the invaders. Perhaps they were not given any chance of converting them. After an interval, one of their leading luminaries, afterwards known as St. David, accomplished the general conversion of what is now Wales. Apart from this, British Christianity languished in its refuges, and might well have become moribund but for the appearance of a remarkable and charming personality. St. Patrick was a Roman Briton of good family, dwelling probably in the Severn Valley. His father was a Christian deacon, a Roman citizen, and a member of the municipal council. One day in the early 5th century, there descended upon the district a band of Irish raiders, burning and slaying. The young Patrick was carried off and sold into slavery in Ireland. Whether he dwelt in Connaught or in Ulster is disputed, and the evidence is contradictory. It may well be that both versions are true, and that both provinces may claim the honour. For 6 years, wherever it was, he tended swine, and loneliness led him to seek comfort in religion. He was led by miraculous promptings to attempt escape. Although many miles separated him from the sea, he made his way to a port, found a ship, and persuaded the captain to take him on board. After many wanderings, we find him in one of the small islands off Marseille, then a centre of the new monastic movement spreading westward from the eastern Mediterranean. Later, he consorted with Bishop Germanus of Auxerre. He conceived an earnest desire to return good for evil, and spread the tidings he'd learned among his former captors in Ireland. After 14 years of careful training by the bishop, and self-preparation for what must have seemed a forlorn adventure, Patrick sailed back in 432 to the wild regions which he'd quitted. His success was speedy and undying. He organized the Christianity already in existence. He converted kingdoms which were still pagan, and he brought Ireland into touch with the Church of Western Europe and made it indissolubly part of a universal Christendom. On a somewhat lower plane, although also held in perpetual memory, was the banishing of snakes and reptiles of all kind from the Irish soil, for which, from age to age, his fame has been celebrated. It was therefore in Ireland, and not in Wales or England, that the light of Christianity now burned and gleamed through the darkness. And it was from Ireland that the gospel was carried to the north of Britain, and for the first time cast its redeeming spell upon the Pictish invaders. Columba, born half a century after St. Patrick's death, but an offspring of his church and imbued with his grace and fire, proved a new champion of the faith. From the monastery which he established in the island of Iona, his disciples went forth to the British kingdom of Strathclyde, to the Pictish tribes of the north, and to the Anglian kingdom of Northumbria. He's the founder of the Scottish Christian Church. Thus, the message which St. Patrick had carried to Ireland came back across the stormy waters and spread through wide regions. There was, however, a distinction in the form of Christianity which reached England through the mission of St. Columba, and that which was more generally accepted throughout the Christianized countries of Europe. It was monastic in its form, and it travelled from the east through Northern Ireland to its new home without touching at any moment the Roman centre. The Celtic churches therefore received a form of ecclesiastical government which was supported by the loosely knit communities of monks and preachers, and was not in these early decisive periods associated with the universal organization of the papacy. In spite of the slow means of travel and scanty news, the papacy had from an early stage followed with deep attention the results of St. Columba's labors. Its interest was excited not only by the spread of the gospel, but also by any straying from the true path into which new Christians might be betrayed. It saw with thankfulness an ardent Christian movement afoot in these remote northern islands, and with concern that it was from the outset independent of the papal throne. These were the days when it was the first care of the Bishop of Rome that all Christ's sheep should be gathered into one fold. Here in the north, where so much zeal and fervour were evident, the faith seemed to be awkwardly and above all separately planted. For various reasons, including the spreading of the gospel, it was decided in the closing decade of the 6th century that a guide and teacher should be sent to England to diffuse and stimulate the faith, to convert the heathen, and also to bring about an effective working union between British Christians and the main body of the Church. For this high task, Pope Gregory, afterwards called the Great, and the ecclesiastical statesmen gathered in Rome selected a trusty and cultured monk named Augustine. St. Augustine, as he's known to history, began his mission in 596 under hopeful auspices. Kent had always been the part of the British island most closely in contact with Europe, and in all its various phases, the most advanced in culture. The King of Kent had married Bertha, a daughter of the Frankish king, the descendant of Clovis, now enthroned in Paris. Although her husband still worshipped Thor and Woden, Queen Bertha had already begun to spread the truth through courtly circles. Her chaplain, an earnest and energetic Frank, was given full rein, and thus a powerful impulse came to the people of Kent, who were already in a receptive mood towards the dominant creed of Western Europe. St. Augustine, when he landed in Kent, was therefore aware that much had been prepared beforehand. His arrival infused a mood of action. With the aid of the Frankish princess, he converted King Ethelbert, who had, for reasons of policy, long meditated this step. Upon the ruins of the ancient British church of St. Martin, he refounded the Christian life of Canterbury, which was destined to become the centre and summit of religious England. Ethelbert, as overlord of England, exercised an effective authority over the kingdoms of the south and west. His policy was at once skilful and ambitious. His conversion to Christianity, however sincere, was also in consonance with his secular aims. He was himself, as the only English Christian ruler, in a position where he might hold out the hand to the British princes, and by using the Christian faith as a bond of union, establish his supremacy over the whole country. This, no doubt, was also in accordance with the ideas which Augustine had carried from Rome. Thus, at the opening of the 7th century, Ethelbert and Augustine summoned a conference of all the British Christian bishops. The place chosen in the Severn Valley was on the frontier between the English and British domains, and far outside the bounds of the Kentish kingdom. Here, then, would be a chance of a general and lasting peace for both races, reconciled in the name of Christ. And of this settlement, Ethelbert and his descendants could securely expect to be the heirs. We must regret that this hope, sustained by sagacious and benevolent politics, was not realized. It failed for two separate reasons. First, the sullen and jealous temper of the British bishops, and secondly, the tactless arrogance of St. Augustine. There were two conferences with an interval. The discussions were ostensibly confined to interesting but uncontroversial questions. There was the date of Easter, which is still debated, and also the form of the tonsure. Augustine urged the Roman custom of shaving only the top of the head. The British bishops had perhaps imitated the Druidical method of shaving from the centre to the ears, leaving a fringe on the forehead. It was a choice of the grotesque. These were matters well capable of adjustment, but they conveniently offered ample pasture upon which the conferences could browse in public, while the vital issues were settling themselves in an atmosphere of goodwill or being definitely compacted behind the scenes. But the British bishops were found in no mood to throw themselves into the strong embraces of Rome. Why should they, who had so long defended the faith against horrible cruelties and oppression, now receive their guidance from a Saxon Kentish king, whose conversion was brand new, and whose political designs, however inspiring, were nonetheless obvious? The second conference ended in a complete rupture. When Augustine found himself in the presence of what he deemed to be unreasonable prejudice and deep-seated hostility, when he saw the few bishops who'd been won over, reproached by their brethren as backsliders and traitors, he fell back quite quickly upon threats. If British Christianity would not accept the fair offers now made, the whole influence and prestige of Rome would be thrown against them upon the English side. The Saxon armies would be blessed and upheld by Rome and by the unbroken traditions of the main Christian church, and no sympathy would be felt for those long, faithful British Christians when they had their throats cut by the new English convert states. "If," the saint exclaimed, "you will not have peace from your friends, you shall have war from your foes." But this was no more than the British had faced for 200 years. It was a language they understood. The conference separated in enmity. The breach was irreparable. All further efforts by Rome through Ethelbert and the Kentish kingdom to establish even the slightest contact with Christian Britain were inexorably repulsed. Augustine's mission, therefore, drew to a dignified but curtailed end. Except for the consecration of Mellitus as the bishop of the East Saxons in a church on the site of St. Paul's, he'd made little attempt to proselytize outside Kent. From the title loosely accorded him of Apostle of the English, he enjoyed for many centuries the credit of having reconverted the once famous Roman province of Britannia to the Christian faith. And this halo has shone about him until comparatively recent times. Almost a generation passed before envoys from Rome began to penetrate into northern England and rally its peoples to Christianity. And then it came about in the wake of political and dynastic developments. By a series of victories, Redwald, king of the East Angles, had established a wide dominion over the lands of central England, from the Dee to the Humber. With Redwald's aid, the crown of Northumbria was gained by an exiled prince, Edwin, who by his abilities won his way, step by step, to the foremost position in England. Even before the death of his ally Redwald, Edwin was recognised as overlord of all the English kingdoms except Kent, and the Isles of Anglesey and Man were also reduced by his ships. He not only established his personal primacy, but the confederation founded by him foreshadowed the kingdom of all England, that was later to take shape under the kings of Mercia and Wessex. Edwin married a Christian princess of Kent, whose religion he'd promised to respect. Consequently, in her train from Canterbury to Edwin's capital at York, there rode in 625 the first Roman missionary to northern England, Paulinus, an envoy who'd first come to Britain in the days of St. Augustine, 24 years before. We have a picture agreeable and instructive of Edwin. There was then a perfect peace in Britain, wheresoever the dominion of King Edwin extended, and, as it is still proverbially said, a woman with her newborn babe might walk throughout the island from sea to sea without receiving any harm. That king took such care for the good of his nation that in several places where he'd seen clear springs near the highways, he caused stakes to be fixed with proper drinking vessels hanging on them for the refreshment of travellers. Nor durst any man touch them for any other purpose than that for which they were designed, either for the great fear they had for the king or for the affection which they bore him. He revived the Roman style. Not only were his banners borne before him in battle, but even in peace when he rode about his cities, townships, or provinces with his thanes. A standard-bearer was always wont to go before him when he walked anywhere in the streets, in the Roman fashion. Such, in his heyday, was the prince to whom Paulinus resorted. Paulinus converted Edwin, and the ample kingdom of Northumbria, shaped like England itself in miniature, became Christian. But this blessed event brought with it swift and dire consequences. The overlordship of Northumbria was fiercely resented by King Penda of Mercia, or, as we should now say, of the Midlands. The drama unfolded with staggering changes of fortune. In 633, Penda, the heathen, made an unnatural alliance with Cadwallon, the Christian British king of North Wales, with the object of overthrowing the suzerainty of Edwin and breaking the Northumbrian power. Here, for the first time noticed in history, British and English fought side by side. Politics, for once, proved stronger than religion or race. In a savage battle near Doncaster, Edwin was defeated and slain, and his head, not the last, was exhibited on the ramparts of captured York. It may be that York, long the home of a legion, still preserved Roman-British traditions, which led them to welcome the British victors. This sudden destruction of the greatest king who had hitherto ruled in the island brought in recoil an equally speedy vengeance. British Cadwallon had triumphed over Northumbria. Here at last was the chance, so long expected, of British vengeance upon their Saxon foes. Here was the faithful paying off of very old but very heavy debts. We might almost be seeing again the spirit of Boadicea. But the inherent power of Northumbria was great. The name and fame of the slaughtered Edwin rang through the land. His successor, Oswald of the House of Bernicia, which was one of the two provinces of the kingdom, had but to appear to find himself at the head of the newly Christianized and also infuriated Saxon warriors. Within a year of the death of Edwin, Oswald destroyed Cadwallon and his British forces in a hard battle which fell out along the line of the Roman Wall. This was the last pitched battle between the Britons and the Saxons, and it must be admitted that the Britons fared as badly in conduct as in fortune. They joined with the heathen Saxon Midlands to avenge their wrongs, and had exploited an English movement towards the disunity of the land. They'd shattered this bright hope of the Christianity they professed, and now they were themselves overthrown and cast aside. The long story of their struggle with the invaders ended thus in no fine way. But what is important to our tale is that it had ended at last. The destruction of Cadwallon and the clearance from Northumbria of the wild western Britons, whose atrocities had united all the Saxon forces in the north, was the prelude to the struggle with King Penda. He was regarded by the Saxon tribes as one who'd brought boundless suffering and slaughter upon them through a shameful pact with the hereditary foe. Nevertheless, he prospered for a while. He upheld the claims of Thor and Woden with all the strength of Mercia for 7 years. He defeated, decapitated, and dismembered King Oswald, as he destroyed his predecessor before him. But a younger brother of Oswald, Oswy by name, after a few years settled the family account, and Penda fell by the sword he'd drawn too often. Thus the power of Northumbria rose the stronger from the ordeal and eclipse through which its people had passed. The failure of Ethelbert's attempt to make a Christian reunion of England and Britain left the direction of the immediate future with the Northumbrian court. It was to York and not to Canterbury that Rome looked, and upon English, not British, armies that the hopes of organized Christendom were placed. When the disasters had overtaken Northumbria, Paulinus had hastened back by sea to Canterbury. Neither he nor Augustine was the kind of man to face the brutal warfare of those times. Carefully trained as they were in the doctrines, interests, and policy of the papacy, they were not the stuff of which martyrs or evangelists are made. This British incursion was too rough. But the lieutenant of Paulinus, one James the Deacon, stuck to his post through the whole struggle, and preached and baptized continually in the midst of rapine and carnage. Still more important than his work was that of the Celtic mission to Northumbria under St. Aidan. Much of Mercia and East Anglia, as well as Northumbria, was recovered to Christianity by the Celtic missionaries. Thus two streams of the Christian faith once more met in England, and the immediate future was to witness a struggle for supremacy between them. With the defeat and death of Penda, and upon the surge of all the passions which had been loosed, Anglo-Saxon England was definitely rallied to the Christian faith. There was now no kingdom in which heathen practices prevailed. Indeed, apart from individuals whose private adherence to Woden was overlooked, the whole island was Christian. But this marvellous event, which might have brought in its train so many blessings, was marred by the new causes of division which now opened between the English and British peoples. To the ferocious British-English racial feud, there was added a different view of church government, which sundered the races almost as much as the difference between Christianity and heathenism. Henceforward, the issue is no longer whether the island shall be Christian or pagan, but whether the Roman or the Celtic view of Christianity shall prevail. These differences persisted across the centuries, much debated by all the parties concerned. The celebrated and largely successful attempt to solve them took place at the Synod of Whitby in 663. There, the hinging issue was whether British Christianity should conform to the general life plan of Christendom, or whether it should be expressed by the monastic orders which had founded the Celtic churches of the north. The issues hung in the balance, but in the end, after much pious dissertation, the decision was taken that the Church of Northumbria should be a definite part of the Church of Rome and of the Catholic system. Mercia soon afterwards conformed. Though the Celtic leader and his following retired in disgust to Iona, and the Irish clergy refused to submit, the importance of this event cannot be overrated. Instead of a religion controlled by the narrow views of abbots pursuing their strict rule of life in their various towns or remote resorts, there was open to every member of the English Church the broad vista of a world state and universal communion. These events brought Northumbria to her zenith. In Britain, for the first time, there was achieved a unity of faith, morals, and church government covering 5/6 of the island. The decisive step had been taken in the spiritual sphere. The island was now entirely Christian, and by far the greater and more powerful part was to be directly associated with the papacy. Rome had had little reason to be satisfied with the mission of either Augustine or Paulinus. The papacy realized that its efforts to guide and govern British Christianity through the Kingdom of Kent had been misplaced. It now made a new plan, which illustrates the universal character of the Catholic Church. Two fresh emissaries were chosen in 668 to carry the light into the northern mists. The first, a native of Asia Minor, Theodore of Tarsus. The second, an African named Hadrian from Carthage. These missionaries were of a stronger type than their precursors, and their character and integrity shone before all. When they arrived at Canterbury, there were but 3 bishops from all England to greet them. When their work was finished, the Anglican Church raised its mitred front in a majesty which has not yet been dimmed. Before he died in 690, Theodore had increased the number of bishoprics from 7 to 14, and by his administrative skill he gave the church a new cohesion. This remarkable Asiatic was the earliest of the statesmen of England, and guided her steps with fruitful wisdom. There followed a long and intricate rivalry for leadership between the various Anglo-Saxon kings, which occupied the 7th and 8th centuries. It was highly important to those whose span of life was cast in that period, but it left small marks on the subsequent course of history. Let a few words suffice. The primacy of Northumbria was menaced and finally ended by the inherent geographical and physical weakness of its position. It was liable to be beset from every quarter, from the north by the Picts, on the west by the British kingdom of Strathclyde, in the south by Mercia, those jealous Midlands still smarting from the suppression of Penda and the punishments inflicted upon his adherents. These antagonisms were too much for Northumbria to bear, and although great efforts were made, and amid the exhausting feuds of rival kings some wise chieftains occasionally prevailed, its collapse as the leading community in the island was inevitable. Northumbria was fortunate, however, in having in this twilight scene a chronicler, to whom we have already referred, whose words have descended to us out of the long silence of the past. Bede, a monk of high ability, working unknown in the recesses of the church, now comes forward as the most effective and almost the only audible voice from the British Islands in these dim times. Unlike Gildas, Bede wrote history, and the name of the Venerable Bede still carries with it a proud renown. He alone attempts to paint for us, and so far as he can, explain the spectacle of Anglo-Saxon England in its first phase. A Christian England, divided by tribal, territorial, dynastic, and personal feuds into what an Elizabethan antiquary called the Heptarchy, seven kingdoms of varying strength, all professing the gospel of Christ and striving over each other for mastery by force and fraud. For almost exactly 100 years, from 731 to 829, there was a period of ceaseless warfare conducted with cruelty and rapine under a single creed. The leadership of Saxon England passed to Mercia. For nearly 80 years, two Mercian kings asserted or maintained their ascendancy over all England south of the Humber. Ethelbald and Offa reigned each for 40 years. Ethelbald had been an exile before he became an autocrat. As a fugitive, he consorted with monks, hermits, and holy men. On attaining power, he did not discard his Christian piety, but he found himself much oppressed by the temptations of the flesh. St. Guthlac had comforted him in misfortune and poverty, but St. Boniface was constrained to rebuke him for his immorality. The moral sense had grown so strong in matters of sex that churchmen could now brand a king as licentious. Boniface, from Germany, censured Ethelbald for the twofold sin, which he committed in nunneries by using the advantages of his royal position to gain himself favours otherwise beyond his reach. The chronicles of this sovereign are scanty. He showed charity to the poor. He preserved law and order. In the south, in 733, he raided Wessex, and in 740 he laid parts of Northumbria waste while its harassed chief was struggling with the Picts. After this last victory, he took to styling himself King of the Southern English and King of Britain. South of the Humber, these claims were made good. Ethelbald, having been at length murdered by his guards, was succeeded by a greater man. Little is known of Offa, who reigned for the second 40 years, but the imprint of his power is visible not only throughout England, but upon the continent. Offa was the contemporary of Charlemagne. His policy interlaced with that of Europe. He was reputed to be the first King of the English, and he had the first quarrel since Roman times with the mainland. Charlemagne wished one of his sons to marry one of Offa's daughters. Here we have an important proof of the esteem in which the Englishman was held. Offa stipulated that his son must simultaneously marry a daughter of Charlemagne. The founder of the Holy Roman Empire appeared at first incensed at this assumption of equality, but after a while he found it expedient to renew his friendship with Offa. It seems that the King of the English had placed an embargo upon continental merchandise, and the inconvenience of this retaliation speedily overcame all points of pride and sentiment. Very soon, Offa was again the Emperor's dearest brother, and Charlemagne is seen agreeing to arrange that there should be reciprocity of royal protection in both countries for merchants, according to the ancient custom of trading. Apparently the commodities in question were black stones, presumably coal, from France, in return for English cloaks. There were also questions of refugees and extradition. Charlemagne was interested in repatriating a Scot who ate meat in Lent. He sent presents of an ancient sword and silken mantles. Thus we see Offa admitted to equal rank with the greatest figure in Europe. It is evident that the island power must have counted for a great deal in these days. Monarchs of mighty empires do not make marriage contracts for their children and beat out the details of commercial treaties with persons of no consequence. The advantage given by these two long reigns, when everything was in flux, had reinstated the island again as a recognisable factor in the world. We know that Offa styled himself not only Rex Anglorum, but also King of the whole land of the English, Rex Totius Anglorum Patriae. This expression, Rex Anglorum, is rightly signalised by historians as a milestone in our history. Here was an English king who ruled over the greatest part of the island, whose trade was important, and whose daughters were fit consorts for the sons of Charles the Great. We learn about Offa almost entirely through his impact on his neighbours. It is clear from their records that he suppressed the under-kings of the Severn Valley, that he defeated the West Saxons in Oxfordshire and subjugated Berkshire, that he decapitated the King of East Anglia, that he was master of London, that he extirpated the monarchy which Hengist had founded in Kent and put down a Kentish rising with extreme severity. Henceforth he gave his own orders in Kent. He captured its mint and inscribed his name upon the coins issued by the Archbishop of Canterbury. One of these coins tells its own quaint tale. It is a gold dinar, nicely copied from an Arabic die, and is stamped with the superscription, Rex Offa. The Canterbury Mint evidently regarded the Arabic as mere ornamentation, and all men would have been shocked had they known that it declared, "There is no God but one, and Mohammed is his prophet." Offa established a good understanding with the Pope. The Supreme Pontiff addressed him as Rex Anglorum. The papal envoys in 787 were joyfully received in the hall of Offa, and were comforted by his assurances of reverence for St. Peter. These professions were implemented by a small annual tribute to the papacy, part of it unwittingly paid in these same infidel coins which proclaimed an opposite creed. In studying Offa, we are like geologists who, instead of finding a fossil, find only the hollow shape in which a creature of unusual strength and size undoubtedly resided. Alcuin, one of the few recorders of this period at the court of Charlemagne, addresses Offa in these terms. "You are a glory to Britain and a sword against its enemies." We have a tangible monument of Offa in the immense dike which he caused to be built between converted Saxon England and the still unconquered British. The tables were now turned, and those who'd never faltered in the old faith, and had always maintained their independence, had sunk in the estimation of men from the mere fact that they lived in barren mountainous lands, while their successful ravishers strode on in pomp and even dignity. This dike, which runs over the hills and dales, leaving gaps for the impenetrable forests, from the mouth of the Severn to the neighbourhood of the Mersey, attests to our day the immense authority of the state over which Offa presided. When we reflect how grim was the struggle for life, and how the getting of enough food to keep body and soul together was the prime concern not only of families but of whole peoples, the fact that this extensive rampart could have been mainly the work of a lifetime and the will of a single man is startling. It conveys to us an idea of the magnitude and force of Offa's kingdom. Such works are not constructed except upon a foundation of effective political power. But Offa's dike shows policy as well as manpower. In many sections, it follows lines favourable to the British, and historians have concluded that it was a boundary rather than a fortification, and resulted from an agreement reached for common advantage. It was not a Roman wall, like those of Antoninus and Hadrian, between savagery and civilization, but rather the expression of a solemn treaty which for a long spell removed from Offa's problem the menace of a British incursion, and thus set him free with his back secure to parley and dispute with Europe. Art and culture grew in the track of order. The English had brought with them from their continental home a vigorous barbaric art and a primitive poetry. Once established in the island, this art was profoundly affected by the Celtic genius for curve and colour, a genius suppressed by Roman provincialism, but breaking out again as soon as the Roman hand was removed. Christianity gave them a new range of subjects to adorn. The results are seen in such masterpieces as the Lindisfarne Gospels, and the sculptured crosses of northern England. A whole world of refinement and civilization, of which the monasteries were the home, and of which only fragments have come down to us, had come into being. Bede was universally honoured as the greatest scholar of his day. It is to his influence that the world owes the practice, adopted later, of reckoning the years from the birth of Christ. Aldhelm of Malmesbury was the most popular writer in Europe, Of no author were more copies made in the monasteries of the continent. Vernacular poetry flourished. In Wessex, the first steps had been taken in the art of prose writing. Another West Saxon, Boniface from Crediton near Exeter, was the apostle of Germany. In the 8th century, indeed, England had claims to stand in the van of Western culture. After the shapeless confusion of darker centuries, obscure to history and meaningless to almost all who lived through them, we now see a purpose steadily forming. England, with an independent character and personality, might scarcely yet be a part of a world civilization as in Roman times, but there was a new England, closer than ever before to national unity, and with a native genius of her own. Henceforward, an immortal spirit stood forth for all to see. Chapter 6. The Vikings. After the fall of Imperial Rome, the victorious barbarians were in their turn captivated and enthralled by the gospel of Christ. Though no more successful in laying aside their sinful promptings than religious men and women are today, they had a common theme and inspiration. There was a bond which linked all the races of Europe. There was an international organization which, standing erect in every country, was by far the most powerful and indeed the only coherent surviving structure. And at the head of which, the Bishop of Rome revived in a spiritual, or at least in an ecclesiastical form, the vanished authority of the Caesars. The Christian Church became the sole sanctuary of learning and knowledge. It sheltered in its aisles and cloisters all the salvage of ancient days. It offered to men in their strife and error the last solace of human woe, the last restraint of earthly power. Thus, while the light of pagan civilization was by no means wholly extinguished, a new effulgence held, dazzled, and dominated the barbaric hordes, not only in our island, but throughout Europe. They were tamed and uplifted by the Christian revelation. Everywhere, from the Euphrates to the Boyne, old gods were forsworn, and a priest of Christ could travel far and wide, finding in every town an understanding brotherhood and a universal, if sometimes austere, hospitality. Amid the turbulence and ignorance of the age of Roman decay, all the intellectual elements at first found refuge in the church, and afterwards exercised mastery from it. Here was the school of politicians. The virtual monopoly of learning and the art of writing made the churchmen indispensable to the proud and violent chieftains of the day. The clerics became the civil servants, and often the statesmen of every court. They fell naturally, inevitably, into the place of the Roman magistrates, whose garb they wore and wear today. Triumphant barbarism yielded itself insensibly to a structure, reliance upon which was proved on numberless occasions to give success in the unending struggle for power. After the convulsions and disorders of the Dark Ages, when at last daylight fell again on the British island, she awoke to a world also profoundly changed, but devoid neither of form nor majesty. There was even a gentler breeze in the air. The fervour of the converted heathen brought, however, in its train, mischiefs which opened new calamities. The church was bound by its spirit to inculcate mildness and mercy. It was led by zeal and by its interests to fortify in every way the structure of its own power. The humility and faith of the descendants of the invaders soon exposed them, in their human frailty, to an organized